I'm going to start.
That's what we're waiting for.
The CMU podcast, in association with 7 Digital.
This week, YouTube, Amazon and Fyre Festival. It's the CMU podcast, looking back at the last week in the music business. I'm Andy Malt, making good use of the fact that I know that I don't have to set the levels myself this week, and it won't distort if I talk loudly.
And it could still distort.
That's Chris Cook. He's here too. Hello.
It's less likely to distort, but if you get too carried away, it could be a mess. You're back in the studio.
I am.
I nearly said studio then.
You did say studio.
Didn't I? It's because I was sort of half going to say Shoreditch, half studio, and it came out as studio. That's what they should call this studio. Because it's in Shoreditch.
It's not the only studio in Shoreditch,
no,
though.
No, but they could call it... Well, but they should claim the name first before everyone else latches onto my really good idea there.
Yeah, I'm sure everyone will be doing that.
Because you're in the studio, it means that the this week bit that you do over the jingle sounds good this week, I assume. I mean, obviously you've not heard it yet, but we assume that it will, rather than all crackly like it did for the last 2 weeks.
Next time I record from home, I'm really going to crack that levels thing.
Some people would think that when you're recording from home, that I should do the this week bit, so because that bit's important that sounds
no.
good. But I know that you're very protective of the this week jingle, so that wouldn't happen. You don't want to give that up.
That's mine.
You see that as the the tip of the iceberg, and if you give that up...
It's really the thing that I see as, say, a deal breaker when it comes to this podcast. If I don't get to do that, I don't do the podcast.
That's
the way it is.
However crackly our intro sounds, it's a condition of you participating in this weekly discussion of what's been happening in the music business and the wider world of music in the previous 7 days.
Yes.
We're not here next week.
No.
This time next week, we will be both grating and escaping.
No, don't tell people we're going to be grating. That's not a good sales technique.
Or escaping doesn't sound that good, really, does it? Because it sounds like we're trying to get out of our own conference. So, no, we're not going to be grating or escaping, but we are going to be great escaping. That works.
Well, sort of.
Sort of.
We'll be at the Great Escape.
We'll be at the
Great Escape. Because we're contractually obliged to be so.
Providing you get to do the intros at the start of each session. Is that in your contract? I've not read your contract.
Should be.
So we will be at the Great Escape next week on the Thursday and the Friday. CMU Insights at the Great Escape. So the media conference and drugs conference on the Thursday, royalties conference and the export conference on the Friday. If you want more information, go back to last week's podcast. We talked through that in some detail.
Or go to CMUinsights.com and click on the Great Escape button right there on the page. It's big, you can see it. In fact, I think there's on the slidey thing, it goes through each individual conference that we're doing. So if you want to look at a specific thing, it's all there.
And if you want to see how our content slots in with all of the other convention stuff and all the festival stuff that's happening during the 3 days of the Great Escape, if you go to greatescapefestival.com, you can check the planner. There's a convention planner where all the different events are there slotted together. Or better than that, download your Great Escape app.
Yeah, the app's really good this year.
Get your app on your phone. And that's where the festival and the convention all sort of sit alongside. And you can see all of our stuff in the Dukes at Comedia venue. So if you filter by that venue, all of our stuff will come up. All the other stuff is in there too. We do have some final exciting speakers that we're going to confirm next week. Can't tell you who they are yet, but we will be allowed to tell you on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday next week. So in the run-up to the Great Escape in the CMU Daily, there'll be the final few speaker confirmations ahead of us kicking off at 10:45 a.m. on the Thursday morning in Dukes at Comedia 1. Everybody has to be in Dukes by 10:45 a.m. on the Thursday morning. That's a condition. If you don't do that, then you're not allowed into anything else that's happening.
Your pass will be revoked.
Exactly. You'll be banned from everything else that is happening. So we'll be at the Great Escape next week. We won't be podcasting next week. We will be back in 2 weeks' time. But in the meantime, this podcast is going to be...
Oh, this is a good one.
So good. You're going to want to listen to it again next week.
Yes.
And therefore, you won't even notice that we've been missing.
Yes, quite right. And while I might be here in the studio this week, I do need to get home fairly promptly to watch the Eurovision semi-final. So if we could stop all this waffling and hurry along, that'd be great.
That's this week's deadline.
Yeah, yeah.
What time does that kick off?
8 p.m.
8 p.m. UK time.
It's 2:30 now, so I reckon I can do it.
8 p.m. UK time.
Yeah.
Not European time.
I don't care about European time.
In fact, where is it this year?
Kiev.
Well, that'll be like, that's like 10 o'clock Kiev time, isn't it? Are they not 2 hours ahead of us in Ukraine? Surely they must be that far east. That's quite a late night party for the Eurovision
semifinal. Well, that's what Eurovision is, isn't it?
It is one long late night party. But you don't need to watch that, because as any Eurovision trivia fan knows, this United Kingdom of both Great Britain and Northern Ireland doesn't participate in the semi-finals, because while we might have no interest in the European Union and all that nonsense, we're such big fans of the European Broadcasting Union. Just insert the word broadcasting.
It's fine.
And we love it.
Yeah.
And so we, via our TV licence fees, pay for most of Eurovision. And as a result of that, there are some other big broadcasters in Europe who put a lot of money in.
There's five. What are there? There's us, there's Spain, there's Italy, others.
So the big broadcasters of Europe, of which the BBC is one, we put in more money than everybody else. So we leapfrog the semi-finals. We don't even...
So did Ukraine, just for winning last year.
Winning last year. So we go straight to the final. So really, there is no need to watch the semi-finals.
There is, because there's going to be yodeling in this semi-final that I suspect will not go through to the grand final. Because the way they've changed the system with Eurovision, it means that the best songs, i.e. the funniest songs, tend not to go through anymore.
That's because they've now got a jury and public vote together.
Slavko, everyone, spare a thought for Slavko.
Yes.
He did not go through, despite having a long ponytail on top of his head.
So
he swung around.
It's Eurovision this weekend. You're insisting you get home in time for the semi-final. It'll be on Red Button, won't it? Or on the iPlayer.
The iPlayer. Does Red Button still exist?
I assume so. Just for Eurovision. They bring it back every year just so that you can have Eurovision playing on a loop non-stop during Eurovision week. But all this Eurovision chatter is just making the chances of you getting back to your television set for exactly 20:00 hours, 10 p.m. Ukraine time, less and less likely.
The irony! Okay, well, let's get on with it then. Coming up this week on the CMU podcast, we're going to talk about Amazon's new moves in live music and AI and the astonishing amount of Fyre Festival legal news. But first, let's talk about Warner renegotiating its licensing deal with YouTube, which is a thing that happened last week now.
Towards the end of last
week. But after we recorded last week's podcast.
So yes, Warner has agreed a new deal with big, bad YouTube. Warner Music being the first of the major record companies to do a deal with YouTube way back in the day, before YouTube was a Google subsidiary, when it was gaining momentum and everyone in the music industry was like, hang on, what's this? On music videos out there on this video thing. And Warner was...
Who's videoed all these cats?
It was sort of before the cats.
I think it was always about
You
cats.
Think cats are in there from the start?
I think the cats were the first on just anywhere.
But maybe not from Warner's point of view. The sinking of Warner released music over the cats. Were people putting their cat videos to Green Day in 2007, 2008?
Yeah, I'm sure they were, yeah.
Or Prince, because as we know...
Not Prince.
That's a big no-no. So Warner...
The rule is Prince, babies, Green Day, cats. That's the general...
That's the way it goes. But
Michael Jackson, dogs.
You need... Oh, well. So only Warner can, through their licence, provide two-thirds of that thing.
Yes.
But we've gone on a very...
This went off the rails very quickly this week.
Warner were the first major record company to do a licensing deal with YouTube in 2008. Prior to that deal, everyone in the music industry hated YouTube. Then Warner did their deal. Then Sony and Universal, who then subsequently invented the whole Vivo experiment. And then for a few years, when some ad money was rolling in, but really the music industry was still in selling downloads, people were like, oh, YouTube, great marketing platform, getting a bit of money from ad sales, that's nice. And then, of course, a few years back, suddenly YouTube became enemy number... Well, I think initially it was enemy number 3 or 4.
Yeah. It's worked its way up. It's
then enemy number 2. Well. But for the last 2 or 3 years, enemy number 1. But, and this is the sort of the peculiarity of the relationship between the music industry and YouTube, although YouTube is enemy number 1, and at every record industry and music publishing event these days, there has to be a little moment. I'm not quite sure why we put it in the schedule for this year's Great Escape, but it is now compulsory that you have 2 minutes somewhere, not at 11 a.m. because that would be insensitive. But maybe at midday, 2 minutes where everyone can just sort of growl and get really angry about YouTube. That has to happen at every music industry event now.
It's good to have that before lunch when everyone's a bit shaky anyway.
Yes, yes. You don't want it after lunch where everyone's feeling content and happy with the world. Despite that, the music industry continues to work with YouTube.
Yeah.
For various reasons. And as a result of that, Warner's deal was up for renewal, so they've agreed this new deal. But two interesting things. We only know this because of a memo that was sent to staff internally at Warner that then, I think Variety were the first to post it.
But it leaked, didn't it? I mean, maybe that's it. Just Warner just assumed that any memo is going to leak anyway. Then why press release it? Why even have PR people?
But they do, and they normally do.
Well, yeah.
They do have press people, and they do normally announce these things. So, I mean, when Warner re-sign their next deal with Spotify, which has to happen in the next few weeks or certainly a few months, they're going to press release that. They'll be very big. This is really exciting. This is the future. Whereas this one was this memo, initially leaked by Variety, since circulated around the internet. So not only did they not officially announce it, but in the memo, it was very much, we've done a new deal with YouTube. The best thing we can say about it is it's not going to last that long.
Yeah, it was all like, hey, this is some great news. We've done a new deal. But yeah, it's very short. So we'll be able to start negotiating another one soon. And who doesn't love negotiating deals?
And then, of course, there was the compulsory paragraph about Safe Harbor. Just as this memo was working its way around the World Wide Web last weekend, I think the memo went out on Friday US time.
Yeah.
So it was sort of doing the rounds last weekend. We were at the Spot Festival, we being CMU.
Yeah, I wasn't.
You weren't. You weren't invited because they wouldn't. Well, you were invited, but they wouldn't let you do the initial announcement of what was happening. And so,
So I said no. Andy, I will not go.
Andy refused to go.
I would really like to go to that festival again. Very good.
Well, you have to give in and accept that you're not going to get to do the this year bit at the start.
Last time, that was the festival I went to. It was sponsored by a ferry company, so they took me on a ferry, a 19-hour ferry to Denmark, which I quite enjoyed.
It was, but that was, I remember that year where you said, oh, everyone's going on a ferry, that'll be fun. And you went on the ferry, but then it was like two of you going on the ferry and everybody else from the media and the industry got a flight.
It was supposed to be a big party on the ferry on the way over, and then it got gradually downsized until it was me and some other people and no party.
So I flew.
We did go and see the provided entertainment, a guy playing a guitar in the bar.
On the boat.
Yeah. So, you know, bit of a party.
I flew to Aarhus, which is the Danish city where the Aarhus Spot Festival. Is that how you're saying it?
That's how it's pronounced.
That sounds very Scottish.
The double A signifies or. It used to be circle over the A, but they changed it. There was some, because apparently you can just change grammar now.
Is that what you learn when you go there by boat? Do they tell you that? Or are you sailing
No,
in?
I didn't learn that on the boat.
So I flew. It's a very small airport. A very, very, very small airport. I think it has, well, it claims to have four gates, but that's because each gate is two gates. That's sort of cheating, isn't it? So my flight was both gate three and gate four.
Oh, that is cheating.
So a very small airport, although it sort of is a shed. I mean, they've done it up quite nicely inside. But then they've actually got a garden where you can go and sit outside waiting for your plane, which was called something like the Garden of Mythology or something.
Were there a lot of myths in there?
I didn't actually go in because I was busy doing some Great Escape admin on my laptop. So I didn't get to go and sit in the Garden of Mythology.
We've gone off track slightly again.
I'm blaming
we?
You.
Is there a reason for this?
You're the chair of this conversation, so you should be directing the speech better.
Well, I am. I'm directing it now. What are you talking about?
CMU Insights at Spot Plus. First time we'd presented at the Spot Festival was YouTube Friend or Foe, where we reviewed the safe harbour of copyright law, which was dissed once again in the Warner memo last weekend. So we don't really have time to go into this. I wrote a little thing, didn't I, ahead of the Spot event, which is on the CMU Insights blog.
Also, if you've been listening to the podcast for a while, you've probably heard us talk about safe harbours 70 or 80 times now.
So if you, either you know it because you're a regular listener, and if so, well done. Well done for being a regular.
If you're not a regular listener, if this is your first time, literally pick any other episode of this podcast and you'll probably find some explanation of safe harbours.
Or go on the CMU Insights blog and we explain it in five steps. So it's the bit of copyright law that YouTube exploits, that the music industry doesn't like, that the music industry say means that YouTube is able to pressure record companies and music publishers and collecting societies into signing up to much less preferential deals than they would normally expect. And Warner was saying that they still felt that their hands were tied, or behind their back, which metaphor's better, that they didn't get to negotiate.
Tied behind their back. just combine both.
Didn't get to negotiate this deal in a fair free market because of the safe harbour. So it's sort of why that it was kind of a sort of a downbeat announcement saying, we've done this deal, it's the best we could do, but safe harbour's value gap, we need to rewrite copyright law. And a lot of the music industry people in the room at the Spot event, including Niels Mossumgaard, I think that's how you say his name, who is a songwriter who is also chairman of the Danish Performing Rights Organisation on the songwriting side, which is called CODA, also heads up the sort of organisation for songwriters in Denmark. And he was very vocal in saying that the Danish songwriting community are very behind the campaign to get safe harbours reformed in Europe, which is where it's most likely to happen. Although we were also joined by Rasmus Nordqvist, I think that's how you say his name, who is a member of the Danish Parliament and represents the alternative party in the Danish Parliament on various things, including culture and also EU affairs. And although he was very sympathetic towards songwriters, actually his background is sort of in art and design himself. But although he was very sympathetic and said that the Danish songwriters were actually doing a good job of being heard in the Danish Parliament, and actually companies like Google and Facebook who are trying to defend the safe harbour, they might be quite active in Brussels, but at a national level, actually, they don't really put much effort in. They probably do here in London, but a lot of the other European countries, they just really lobby in Brussels. Although he did agree with me, and possibly you.
More likely me.
That the bit of the European Copyright Directive, which is attempting to limit the safe harbour in order to increase the liabilities of user upload platforms like YouTube, as it is currently written, and if anything, it is likely to be revised to YouTube's advantage rather than tightened up to the music industry's advantage. As it is currently written, it is very likely, we both felt, not all the music people in the room agreed, but we both felt that if it goes through, YouTube will almost immediately say, we're already compliant with that, which means that somebody will have to test that in court. So if you think about the year, it's probably another year to get the copyright directive finished. Someone was telling me the other day that there was some ridiculous number of proposed amendments to the directive they've now got to plough through. So if it takes another year to go through, then at least a year from the directive going through at a European level to it being implemented into national law. So obviously there's the race on. What will go through first, Brexit or the European Copyright Directive for us here in the UK? But let's say it takes 2 to 3 years to actually become a law. Then YouTube say, we're already compliant. So then somebody has to sue them. Let's say that's probably going to be maybe Gamer in Germany. So they sue through the German courts. Probably takes 2-3 years to work its way through the German courts. If Google were to lose, they would presumably appeal it all the way. It might even have to bounce back to the European Courts of Justice, maybe 4-5 years. We're talking quite a long time before that safe harbour revision actually comes into force, even if everything swings in the music industry's favour. I mean, unless Google feels pressured to act on its own accord. But let's assume that they don't, and it has to go through the...
they haven't yet, have they?
And it has to go through the full legal process. Then you're looking at, what, 2022, best-case scenario, 2023, and where will we be by the sort of mid-2020s in terms of streaming music? Things are moving so rapidly. I think digital music in the mid-2020s will be unrecognisable to what we've got now. So I'm not saying that you shouldn't...
stream everything upside down.
Through your middle finger.
Yeah.
Or something like that. So, although I would say the music industry is almost certainly right that the people who wrote Safe Harbours in the 90s never envisaged services like YouTube from using them, and therefore there probably is an argument that YouTube is exploiting a loophole in copyright law, and there's also an argument that that loophole is damaging the sort of the basic principle of copyright, and therefore copyright owners probably should stand up for that. But you do sort of sense amongst part of the music industry, just the same way as they used to be with things like free strikes and cracking down on file sharing, if we could just get this sorted, everything's going to be brilliant. And A, I don't think you are going to get this sorted. And even if you do, I don't think it's this that is going to make recorded music go and have another heyday. So that's not to say that the efforts to get safe harbour reform shouldn't continue, but I think more stuff needs to be done on the side. And indeed, Leah Cohen, formerly of Warner Music,
now heading up music stuff at YouTube.
He gave an interview shortly after this memo had been leaked.
Recode, I think.
In which he was saying, well, when we were having our talks, it was all very positive about how YouTube's growing and we're building a subscription business and we're going to raise some more ad income over here. And everyone was really happy.
Yes, and he was very surprised about the content of Warner CEO Steve Cooper's memo, because the subject of safe harbours never came up in the negotiations. As you say, it was all positive about, you know, growing YouTube to the positive outcome of everyone involved. So so growing YouTube's nominal subscription service
Red,
and also
it's called Red.
It's called Red.
I'm not just randomly saying Red.
who knows, sometimes you do, sometimes you don't. It's hard to know. And also growing the ad business. And it was interesting that he was saying that Warner and YouTube both see the ad business, the subscriptions business, as coexistent important things rather than other streaming services that see adverts as a thing that will annoy people into signing up for a premium service.
And also talking about how if you take a global perspective, there are some emerging markets where realistically paid for subscriptions aren't going to take off in the near future. So that's where you really want to focus your effort on the free services. Meanwhile, where there are markets where potentially paid for subscriptions could take off, we should be focusing on that. So he was basically saying there's so many opportunities here. Warner get those opportunities. Why all the negativity? Although, you know, in his former life as a record industry exec, he was prone to wheel out some negativity about these services. Although, I suppose, after leaving Warner, when he had his own business, he was collaborating with the tech companies.
So. And he did say in the interview also that, you know, he still sees himself as very much a music industry guy. And so if he felt that YouTube genuinely was trying to screw over artists and labels, he would not have taken a job there. Although I'm sure they offered him a lot of money.
I'm sure that they did. I suppose the conclusion here, even though it's a wishy-washy taking the middle line conclusion, is, OK, you're probably right on safe harbours and you probably should be talking out about that, but I don't really think that's the solution. So at the same time, you need to be, A, looking at how you can make more money out of YouTube and what you can persuade YouTube to do without just asking for a big upfront advance or minimum guarantees, which we know we won't get. What can we do to make more money out of YouTube? And also look beyond YouTube and at the potential services out there, which are going to be the next cash cows that no one has even thought of yet. But I suppose, to be fair to Warner Music, they are trying to do that middle thing of being part of the Safe Harbour Reform campaign over here, but at the same time recognising there is some revenue to be made. It's a great marketing platform. We have to carry on working with YouTube over here in the best possible way that we can. And I suppose, although we were sort of mocking the fact that it's a relatively short-term deal and that was the best thing they could say about it, but the world is moving fast at the moment. You know, there is an element of saying you don't want to lock yourself in to a four-year arrangement because who knows where digital music and YouTube's role in the equation will be in 4 years' time.
Yeah.
So in some ways, that's quite a sensible thing. We are expecting Sony and Universal to also renew their deals, although that generally includes Vivo in the mix. So the sort of there's a middleman agency between them and the YouTube platform, but we should see a new deal coming from them soon too. But what we will also continue to see, I am sure, for the near future is plenty of safe harbour, safe harbour, safe harbour, value gap, value gap, value gap statements coming out of the RFPI, the BPI, the PRS, and all the various trade organisations representing the record industry, the publishers, the songwriters, and the artists.
Yes, maybe they could just have a standard email they send out once a week.
Or even better, because we're now in an age where people don't like reading, turn that into a YouTube video.
Yeah.
People would watch that.
I'm sure they would. They wouldn't. Still to come on this week's CMU podcast, we've got some more news in brief. And the many more lawsuits that have been launched against Fyre Festival since we last spoke about it just last week. But now, let's talk about Amazon, because Amazon continues to try to be a big player in music. That's where it's moving into at the moment. So it's done a couple of things this week that are music related. One, as part of its live music thing, I mean, it's obviously it's moved into ticketing. Ticketing's now it's the big thing it's trying to break into in music. And as part of that, they've launched their own series of music events called Prime Live Events, which is a catchy name if I ever heard one, which will be a series of intimate shows by big name artists. They'll only sell tickets to Prime customers, and then they will show video of those performances on the Prime streaming service.
So this is something they, in essence, piloted with Robbie Williams last year, didn't they? So they've already done it once with Robbie, and now they've announced a number of different shows. And yeah, as you say, it sort of feeds into various things that Amazon are doing in music, in that you buy the tickets for Amazon Tickets, and Amazon are really trying to get into ticketing business. They started ticketing here in the UK first, and now trying to grow it out around the rest of the world, but they are particularly active on that here in the UK. It's also part of their Prime Club scheme, in that you have to be a Prime member to have the privilege to spend an awful lot.
It's a huge amount of money.
It's not like these are free tickets for Prime members. You have the privilege to go and spend quite a lot of money. But they're intimate shows, remember?
Oh, yeah.
And they're getting some content out of it that they can then stream through the sort of the video on demand element of it. So interesting to see Amazon, A, expanding its ticketing business, but also locking in other elements of the sort of the Amazon platform into the deal.
Yes. So the first of these shows will be Blondie later this month, playing the Round Chapel in Hackney. That's 750 capacity. Tickets for that will be £150. Is not, that's like at least £120 more than you should ever spend on any gig ever.
To be fair, there are a lot of artists doing, say, big theatre or arena shows where tickets are a lot more than 20 quid.
I know. 30 quid. 30 quid is the maximum anyone should charge for a live show.
I think it's unfair to suggest that Blondie and Amazon are ripping everyone off by charging more than £25 a ticket. It's not that unusual. It does seem quite expensive, but I mean, they would normally be quite a lot more than 25 quid, surely, on a Blondie show.
Well, yeah. Still, 150 quid. And you got to go to the Round Chapel in Hackney. I mean, that's quite like, you got to get the train and then a bus. It's a nightmare. There's no parking around there.
Much better being in an arena. Then there's like a food court and there's parking. And Amazon have built all those.
Yeah, see them at the O2. It'll be much more fun.
Well, haven't Amazon got lounges now for Prime users at the O2 or something?
Well, just go there.
Go and see them in
an
arena.
Don't go to the Round Chapel in Hackney.
None of this intimacy. Who wants to be intimate?
I think they do yoga in there as well.
Do they?
Yeah.
Well, perhaps they're going to combine it. Perhaps Debbie Harry's going to be doing some yoga as well as singing her songs.
If you want cheaper tickets...
That's why it's 150 quid.
Maybe. Katie Melua, Alison Moyer in Texas are also doing shows around London in, slightly smaller venues, actually, but also for less money. So that's where you make your savings. The Blondie show, though, coincides with the 40th anniversary of their first UK show.
Worth a premium, surely.
That's probably worth an extra, I don't know, 15 quid.
Yeah, there you go. That's how they reached that sum. That's how they got it. So that's what Amazon have been up to this week on the live side of music. But what about the recorded side of music?
Well, Amazon this week announced the latest iteration of its Echo digital personal assistant device thing. You know, the thing that you shout at.
Yes. The big news is it has a screen.
It's got a screen now. And
it does sort of feel like we're back to the early days of the iPod. It's got a screen now. These are the developments.
Oh, it is getting dangerously close to the Amstrad email phone. But this is a thing, you know. The only thing anyone's ever been able to tell me about the Alexa Echo thing is that it's really good for setting timers and doing shopping lists, which I can do on my phone already. So I don't think... Currently, it's not being sold to me. However, now it's got a screen, maybe that's the best thing ever.
Had you been at the Spot Festival this weekend, and if, like myself, after your storming panel on Safe Harbours, you had lunch with somebody that you were on a panel with earlier in the day, a.k.a. Benji Rogers, founder of Pledge Music and Dot Blockchain, he's a very big fan of the Echo. I think he possibly would have pitched it to you over... He certainly pitched it to me over lunch.
He's good at pitching, that's the thing.
I was quite excited about the Echo after our lunch, although not so excited that I went and bought one. But that's because then I saw...
Well, you're waiting for the screen.
Well, I saw that on the wire, you see, and I thought, I'm not going to rush home and buy one of those round ones. Now I can spend an extra 100 quid and get a screen.
It's not an extra 100 quid. It's an extra 30 quid.
I thought the Echoes were 150 and now they're 250.
They've dropped it to 150.
Right.
But, you know, when it was going brand new price.
Right.
Anyway, it's not available in the UK. It's not quid anyway. It's dollars.
It is.
$230 it costs. But what's this got to do with music? Well, I'll tell you. Thanks for asking. There's various things that this thing can do. The one they're mainly pushing, top of the list on the reasons you should buy this, is video calls.
So this is the reason why you should need a screen, in addition to having the voice-on-demand stuff.
You can shout at it, call me mum, and then it will call your mum and you'll be able to see it, except you won't, because...
Your mum won't have...
Your mum doesn't know how to point a camera at her face when you're doing a video call.
Except... One of the reasons why Benji was bigging up the Echo was because his mum's got one, she's learnt how to use it, and she's a big fan too.
I tell you what, I did a video call with my parents recently, and they just put the camera just pointed between them. I could see little bits of their heads.
Anyway. Get them an Echo, and you might find within a week they're on video call after video call.
That's number one. Number two on the list is when you shout at it, oi, play me some music, and it plays you music off the Amazon Music Unlimited on-demand streaming service, it will show you the lyrics for that song on the screen.
So you can sing along.
So you can stand next to it and sing along.
Does Alexa join in?
I don't know, maybe.
Yeah, that's something they should add. If not, let's have a sing song, Alexa.
Yeah.
And then you could pick a duet and you could say, you be, what's a good duet that they could be doing? I got you, babe. You be Cher, I'll be Sonny. Let's sing this together. That would get me to buy.
You'd fork out for it then.
An Amazon Echo connected to Music Unlimited. Of course, if you're willing to only access Amazon's Spotify competing Music Unlimited service via this Echo device, it's only £4. Is it £4 a month? Is that what it ends up being in the UK?
£3.99, yeah.
£3.99 a month. You can't have it on your phone or in your car or anywhere else.
But you can have it sort of probably in your kitchen. So you can listen to music standing next to the toaster. And sing along.
Sing along with Alexa, assuming they add that functionality down the line.
Yeah. I always find it funny that at some point in any music service's lifespan, there'll be a big announcement that they're going to let you see the lyrics. I never see how that is a big selling point. Is that a thing that people genuinely want?
People used to buy smash hits back in the 80s for the lyrics. Perhaps that's who they're pitching at. They're pitching at people
who read Smash Hits in the 80s.
People who read Smash Hits in the 80s who miss not being able to get the lyrics, who haven't yet worked out.
I miss Smash Hits in the 80s. I don't know about...
Yeah, it's the intersection of people who liked Smash Hits magazine in the 80s, but who haven't worked out how to use Google and put the word lyrics after a song title. That's who this service is for.
Right, and we've cracked it.
They're going to make a mint on the back of it, I'm sure.
Right, well, Smash Hits fans, get onto Amazon.
So lots of Amazon Music developments this week. And despite all of Andy Malt's cynicism, what I do agree with one of Benji's messages at the panel at Spot, however cynical we may be about individual products, the music industry and everybody in music needs to keep an eye on what Amazon is up to. Because in amongst all of this to-ing and fro-ing, they could end up owning the music industry.
Yes, I do agree.
That is still something that could happen.
People aren't keeping an eye on Amazon nearly closely enough at the moment. Except us, because we seem to talk about it a lot on this podcast. But yeah, follow our lead. That's what I say.
Yes.
Just quickly, time to look through a few of this week's other stories in brief. And we kick off this week with a bit of breaking news.
As we speak. Not as you listen.
Not when you listen to this. But right now, this moment, it is news that has just happened. And that is that Universal has now formally demanded its $30 million back from the Prince estate.
Now, I don't know if we talked about this on the podcast.
We did a bit.
Did we? I thought it fell in one of our weeks off. So Universal earlier this year, late last year.
Yeah.
Anyway, no, earlier this year, because it was around the Grammys, wasn't it? Because it was ahead of Prince coming back to streaming services just for the Grammy Awards, which are returning to New York next year. An extra in brief slotted in there.
Look at you.
Hey. So Universal secured the rights to control and distribute and monetize the Prince recording rights in a $30 million deal earlier this year. Although there are some complications to that deal, because a couple of years before he died, Prince agreed a new deal with Warner Music, his original record company, the record company that he famously fell out with in the 1990s. And so Universal's right to license and distribute Prince's recordings catalogue is subject to the limitations of what rights Warner Music has. And Warner Music has rights over most of the really famous Prince albums from sort of the 80s, and it wasn't really clear exactly what Warner's rights were. They're different in the US than they are the rest of the world. And anyway, to cut a long story short, it turns out that Universal thought they were getting more than they are through this $30 million deal. And once they started digging deeper and worked out the limitations that the existing Warner deal puts on their deal, well, they're not very happy with what they're getting for their $30 million.
No, well, according to Billboard, Universal has accused former estate advisor L. Londell McMillan of fraudulent inducement in connection with that deal and is now calling for the court to rescind the agreement. So that is lots of fun.
Now, there was obviously speculation of this a few weeks ago, which we reported on, and former estate advisor McMillan at that point denied those allegations.
Yes.
So he has already gone on record of denying those allegations, perhaps unsurprisingly. So this will be an interesting one. The Prince litigation is starting to mount. because we're cynical and terrible people, when Prince sadly died, his untimely death last year.
Yeah, we didn't like that bit.
But We discussed how, obviously, one of the biggest pop star deaths, untimely deaths that we've ever reported on was Michael Jackson's death. We don't think we'll ever report on a story that was so big in both an artist and a business sense as the death of Michael Jackson in 2009.
No, that was really the peak of both our careers. It's all downhill.
And we were saying, although sort of Prince and Michael Jackson back in the 80s by smash hits, as it happens, were often sort of pitched as being sort of rival artists and sort of similar artists, even though they never were, but that was how it was positioned. We were saying, oh, well, we don't see there ever being anywhere near the kind of litigation and legal fallout of Prince's death that there was of Michael Jackson's. Obviously, there's not the criminal element to Prince's death that there was of Michael Jackson, but the lawsuits are mounting, and this one could be one very interesting to watch. So we'll dig a bit deeper, so go and check out our report on that on the website.
Pandora, in celebration of its massive quarter one losses this week, raised another $150 million in investment and also said that it's now considering a sale, which has been rumoured for more than a year now.
Yes, although it's an interesting development because various shareholders in Pandora, so obviously the American streaming service, is publicly listed. So it's one of the few digital music platforms that is directly listed on a stock exchange. So we get to scrutinise their finances a little bit more. Various investors in Pandora have been saying for a while that the best future for Pandora will be to sell itself, probably to a bigger tech or media firm, which would therefore mean it was no longer directly listed on the stock exchange, no longer subject to the scrutiny of that listing, and maybe also be able to get some extra finance pumped in from a bigger company owning it, maybe some sort of marketing or distribution tie-ups with a media company or a web company. So various investors have sort of been pushing for Pandora to consider selling itself for a while. You felt for a good year, Pandora had a rejig of their management team, and for a good year they were really resisting that and saying, no, it's all fine, we're revamping our premium services, we're launching the £10 services, we've moved into ticketing, we've got all these new revenue streams, it's all going to be fine. But you sort of sense now that Pandora's top guard are starting to say, yeah, I think what would be best for this company is if we were to sell ourselves, take us off our public listing, get away from the scrutiny of being on the stock exchange, and find some synergies with a bigger company to help us turn this damn thing into profit. So depends how doom and gloom you want to be about the wider digital market. I think Pandora is under pressure to start bringing in decent new revenues. They have the ticketing now, they have the sort of the new premium services now, but are those new sides to the business growing fast enough to keep those shareholders happy? Probably not. They probably need a buyer. Is there a buyer? There were a couple of companies who had expressed interest. Liberty Media was one, although I think it was one of those not at the current asking price. So it'll be interesting to see what happens to Pandora in the near future.
Still on streaming music, Spotify and Deezer are among various companies to back calls to regulate app stores, which feeds on from Spotify's complaints, I think earlier this year, possibly last year now, over the Apple tax. So Apple forces companies like Spotify to basically put their prices up by 30% when they take subscription payments through Apple's system, because Apple takes a 30% cut of that, and that would leave Spotify with no money if it didn't put the price up. However, it's not allowed to say that if you just go to Spotify's website, you can get it for the $9.99, so £3 cheaper.
Yeah, Spotify have been moaning about Apple's system in particular, more in the US than over here in Europe, actually. But this was a European Commission thing, a open letter to the European Commission. Didn't specifically name Apple and Google, just talked about major app stores.
Yeah.
In the mobile system.
Well, there's loads, aren't there?
Well, you could throw Amazon in there, because I mean, yeah, they are sort of a platform that does sit increasingly between customers and content
owners.
Well,
of course, Spotify's big gripe was always, I mean, they've never liked the fact that they've had to charge $12.99 for subscriptions on Apple and Google's app stores. But the problem really got bigger when Apple Music launched. And of course, Apple Music you can buy for $9.99. So actually, it looks like Apple Music is just cheaper than Spotify, Deezer, etc.
Yes, if you're just browsing through the app stores. So yes, so there is more of a beef with Apple because they are a competitor of companies like Spotify. I mean, Google is, but not quite the same way. Also, I think Google's rules on what you can and can't say to your customers are much more relaxed.
Yeah.
They don't have this. You can't tell people there's a cheaper option if they circumvent the app store system. So the European Commission are looking into this, and Spotify and Deezer and others were basically saying, yeah, you should look into this and do something about it. So we'll wait and see if they do.
Yeah, and so you can go and read all of those stories in full at completemusicupdate.com/podcast. You'll find the show notes for this episode. You'll find links to all of those reports. And finally this week, we're back to Fyre Festival. the gift that keeps on giving in terms of legal news, if you happen to be a massive fan of
really messy litigation.
Yeah, which we are. Well, as I know.
I did check this morning with Andy Malt, so it's Thursday today, isn't it? When I ran yet another Fyre Festival class action as top story in the CMU Daily. I did check, can we get away with another Fyre Festival litigation top story? And you were well up for it.
I hope there are more.
Keep it up at the top of the daily, you were saying.
Yeah, so when we spoke about this last week, there were two class action lawsuits that have been filed against Fyre Festival, which already seemed quite excessive.
So these were ticket buyers who'd bought tickets to this disastrous festival that didn't happen in the Bahamas. They'd been promised this luxury experience. It wasn't a luxury experience. Well, either you got to the island and it was a horrible experience, or you never actually, your plane never took off from Miami. And so ticket holders were suing. And as you say, yes, as of last week's podcast, as a ticket holder, there were two class actions that you could choose from in order to try and sue Ja Rule and his best mate, Billy McFarland, the two men behind this disastrous attempt at staging a festival. By the time you wrote the beef of the week on this, which was the day after we recorded the podcast, but before the podcast came out, we were up to three class actions. Yep. And since then, they've just continued to mount.
They just keep coming. So the first three lawsuits were all aimed at getting damages for people who'd bought tickets for the festival and all largely made similar claims, all three of them class actions. Though the second one, slightly different because it made an allegation that various social media influencers, which I know is a term you like greatly, had taken money to promote the event without properly declaring it. And yeah, that contravened Federal Trade Commission rules. The fourth lawsuit, which then came over the weekend, I think, that's all the suppliers getting in on the act. So a company called National Event Services, which was hired to provide medical support on site, sued, saying that basically the infrastructure for them to do that job was not there. What they would need to do that had not been provided. They hadn't booked a helicopter to get people off the site.
Yes,
if
there was
necessary,
a medical emergency.
Like, things like that.
They also provided the fun nugget of information. We already knew that the tents that they put up for their guests were basically tents that are usually used in emergency relief situations. Yeah. They were saying that some of the mattresses that were being put in these tents that people were sleeping on were bloodstained. So that's a nice little extra touch of information to describe the horror of this festival site.
Number five, that was another class action for ticket holders. Number six was bucking the trend. It was trying to get damages for ticket holders, but it was just a couple of ticket holders on their own. They didn't make it a class action.
Yes, they weren't asking for class action.
So they
status.
Were a couple who'd booked a VIP villa to find that that was not a thing that they were going to get. They also sued the event's PR company, 42 West, for not taking reasonable steps to check if the claims made about the festival and what it would be like were true.
Now, that's interesting, isn't it? So most of these suits are suing the companies associated with the Fyre Festival, including Fyre Media.
Plus Ja Rule and Billy McFarland personally.
The two of them personally. But then, yeah, this suit was also suing the PR company and I think an advertising or marketing company, basically saying if you're putting out these press releases and these ads, you should fact check that everything that's being claimed is true. I don't know whether or not they'll be able to keep those guys on as defendants. Meanwhile, celebrity lawyer Mark Gregos, behind the first class action, one of the ones we talked about on last week's podcast, has also said in an interview that he is intending on adding more defendants to his lawsuit down the line. We don't know who yet, but it will include one of those social media influencers, a prominent socialite.
Yeah.
Never know what that means either. And one of the investors in the festival. So there could be an assortment of more people being added to these lawsuits down the line.
Mark Gregos, obviously, with all these lawsuits flowing in, it's getting harder to differentiate yours. So Mark Gregos has added some extra stuff to his. He now accuses Fyre Festival's organisers of fraud, claiming that they knew for weeks that their event would be, in his words, a post-apocalyptic nightmare, but that they went ahead anyway in the hopes of just making loads of money. Basically, they accused him of running a Ponzi scheme. That's six lawsuits. Could there be more? Yes, there could. A seventh one came in, yet another class action, and this one claiming that the festival had continued to sell VIP packages even after it was known internally, but not publicly announced, that it was not going to go ahead.
And one of the allegations in this final lawsuit is that artists and certain staff have been told a few days before, I don't know exactly when, but basically before the event was due to start, yeah, don't come. Yeah. Meanwhile, everyone else was still piling onto planes heading to the island. They had one of those sort of cashless wristband systems where you put money on your wristband.
Yeah.
And people being told, oh, don't forget to put lots of money on your wristband to come and spend on the luxury cheese sandwiches that we'll be selling. And so they're sort of saying, yeah, that there was two lots of messaging going out. And I suppose it is interesting. We assume a lot of the artists who were due to play bailed and didn't go because they hadn't been paid their advances. But as far as I'm aware, no artists went. I don't know how many artists they booked. And that may well have been that the artists and the agents had been told before any planes left, yeah, this isn't happening. Certainly that's the allegation in this seventh lawsuit. So all these class actions, I mean, I suppose we say they're class actions, they're requesting class action status.
Yes.
The judge will have to agree with that. You have to assume when it comes to the class actions and indeed any of the litigation which is relating to ticket holder claims versus supplier claims, well, having said that, they're all suing in different states. I think there's been at least one in, well, the most recent one's in New York. I think there's been one in California. I think Mark Regos' suit's in California. Mm-hmm. There's been one in Florida, the argument being that the flights all left from Miami, so it should be under Florida. So I suppose if they're all in different states, that complicates things even further. But I mean, the sensible thing would be to merge all those into one massive class action,
yeah,
rather than having all these separate cases going through. And maybe one class action for ticket holders and one for suppliers. It wouldn't surprise me if that PR agency and ad agency who are being sued themselves aren't busy putting together their own litigation, as usually happens in the fallout of these events. But yeah, seven and counting.
Yeah, by the time you hear this, there may well be more.
We will continue to count as they are filed. And really, to get a statement, I mean, obviously, Ja Rule and Billy McFarlane put out a statement as the event was being cancelled, being very apologetic, bigging up Fyre Festival 2018. But we're yet to really get any response to any of this litigation.
I would imagine that Billy McFarlane's interview with Rolling Stone and Ja Rule put out a public statement kind of being very apologetic, but saying, it's not my fault. I would imagine that their lawyers instantly came in and went, you shut up.
Yeah, stop.
This is already bad. Stop talking.
Stop saying that, yeah, we really screwed up here and we should have organised things a lot earlier. I mean, I assume that stage one of their response to these lawsuits will be to try and get Ja Rule and Billy McFarlane removed as personal defendants so that just Fyre Media, I think there was also a company called Fyre Festival, are the defendants. But as we discussed on last week's podcast, you have to assume, I don't know, I'm making the assumption that neither of those companies will survive this.
No.
So therefore, the plaintiffs, the claimants in all those lawsuits won't want the individuals taken off as defendants. Otherwise, there will be no money left to go and chase. But you assume that the first efforts of lawyers working for the people involved in the company will be to remove the individuals off the list of defendants. While over here, we'll have Mark Regos busy trying to add everybody in the world. Anyone who's lit a fire, or owned an Amazon fire, or has been fired will get added as defendants on his class action, probably.
Yes, but so while we wait for those that get more lawsuits to flow in.
Yeah, we're not here next week, remember, so there could be 87 by the time we come back in 2 weeks.
I'm sure there'll be developments on the ones that are already there. We may well be talking about this again in 2 weeks' time. But for now, that's all we've got time for on this week's podcast. I think that all of our listeners should now launch their own class action, by which I mean all of you should go and rate this podcast 5 stars on iTunes. It's not really a class action.
No, although it is an action.
It's an action, and you should all do it.
It could be class as in, you know, as an adjective, as in
good. Really, really good action.
Really stylish. It's a class action.
You're very classy people, listeners.
Yeah,
go and rate us 5 stars. That's
what I'm thinking.
It's the classy thing to do.
Yeah.
Failing that, you can come and say hello to one or both of us at The Great Escape next week.
Yeah, I normally forget to eat at The Great Escape because it gets very busy on the 2 days we're presenting conferences. So if somebody could bring me some chips at lunchtime, that would be great. By which I mean chips, not crisps. So Americans need not participate in this. I mean like proper chips or fries. That would be good. And then I won't die at the end of the conference.
I am very good at managing my food intake, so that's fine.
So you just want booze.
You can bring me booze or just hand me your phone and I will rate this podcast 5 stars for you.
And sign you up.
And do the hard work that you seem not interested in doing yourself. This podcast was presented by me, Andy Malt, and Chris Cook. It was produced by Matt Peaty. And for more on CMU, go to completemusicupdate.com.
Recorded at Unique Facilities, the CMU podcast is an unlimited production in association with 7 Digital.
I clicked back and I ended up back on a history of Noel Edmonds' business.
That's it. Let's just talk about that.